This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do I have to tell you that rats are a menace, from the bubonic plague to city streets? But you know that rats, at times, sometimes they're helpful, like when testing out new drugs. And now a new project called Apopo in Tanzania has put rats to work. They've trained the African giant pouched rat to detect landmines and even tuberculosis using its powerful sense of smell. And it turns out our old foe, the common brown rat, with the right training, could soon be joining a detective squad in the Netherlands. What makes rats such a good employee? Aaron Blaisdell is a professor of comparative psychology, University of California in LA, and has found the rat is a lot smarter than we give it credit for. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Monique Hammerschlag is an inspector with the Dutch National Police. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Aaron, what evidence do we have that rats are smart?
Well, they've always been really good in basic learning experiments, like Pavlovian conditioning, Skinnerian conditioning, things like that. But we increasingly understand that some of the core elements of even what we think of as human-like cognition are even present in rats.
Huh. Monique, what are you teaching rats to do for the Dutch National Police?
Well, this particular group I'm working with now, they are being trained to make a discrimination between a certain brand cigarette and counterfeit and other brands. And they're already quite good at it.
They're that good? Just by the sense of smell?
Yeah. Yeah, they don't have to actually smoke. They just smell the cigarette. And I wouldn't allow it.
And how do you teach them to do that?
Well, that's quite easy. I start with little test tubes. Plastic test tubes, and I put small pieces of cigarette in, and I tap them, and I make a small hole in the tap, so that some smell still can get out of the test tube. And every time the rat goes, by coincidence or some other reason, near the test tube with the brand cigarette I want them to report on, I make a clicking noise, and directly after that I feed them. And after a while they think, hey, that's nice. If I sit near that smell, I can make the lady give me food. So the rat actually thinks it's training me. And that's how we teach it. And that's how we started when training them by hand. But it can all be done in a so-called operant chamber, which is a kind of automatic rat trainer.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, what makes them so easy to train?
Well, they've got a lot of great qualities that make them so endearing. One, as I said before, they are quite intelligent, and not just learning, but also reasoning processes. But beyond that, also, they live in large groups, and so they're very social. They have a lot of the social mechanisms of behavior that are also present in, for example, primates or pack-hunting dogs and wolves. And so, actually, they form a good bond with a human. If they're raised in captivity or domesticated, they will actually form a good bond. They'll come to you if you call them. They're a little cute, cuddly. I kind of think of them as little cuddly pussycats or puppy dogs in a way.
You must work a lot with rats.
I do.
Think of them that way. Monique, why not use dogs like we see all over the place?
Yeah, well, we do use dogs, and they will never be replaced by rats, because a dog is a hunter, so you can take them to new places, and they go search for you, and they don't mind if they go to a place they've never been before. Often a rat will freeze first in a new place, so that's not very practical for police work. But what rats can do very well is smell samples, which is a bit of boring job and not very interesting for dogs. So I think they can supplement dogs, but really not replace them.
So you don't take rats out into the field like you would a dog on a leash?
No, I guess it can be done, but it takes a lot of training time for an animal that won't get very old, like maybe 2-3 years, and the dog gets, you can work longer with the dog. Right now we're not taking them into the field, we're taking the smell to the rat.
Aaron, how do rats compare with other animals? Could you train, let's say, a pigeon or a cat to detect the landmines?
That's a good question. Rats, as Monique had said, are great for this kind of work because they're very olfactory driven. Rodents in general have really good sense of smell. And so that makes them, similar to dogs, very useful for detecting things based on the chemical signature that's unique to that substance. Now, pigeons and other species can also be trained to do all kinds of wonderful things for humans, like the carrier pigeons carrying messages. And there were even a few decorated pigeons decorated with medals back in World War I for some of the feats they made of flights they made out of enemy territory back home.
Mm-hmm. Monique, now rats are nocturnal, so how does this affect your work with them?
I work in the dark. when I come to the office in the morning, I kill the lights. We only leave a small light on, so I can see something, and the rats are comfortable because, they don't see very well in the light, and it's actually harmful to them, bright light. So we like them to be comfortable, so we work in the dark, semi-dark. And at night, when I go home, I put on the lights again, and the rats go to sleep.
This project in Tanzania with the trained giant pouched rat to detect landmines and tuberculosis, are these the same kind of rats?
No, it's a different species. I think they might actually be more closely related to the hamster. They also have these big pouches, which is very practical because when you train them, they don't get full. Whereas my rats, they immediately eat their reward, and the pouched rats just store it, and they start eating after the work. So that's really practical. But there are different species. My rat is the Rattus norvegicus, the brown rat, and the other one is the Chrysotomys gambianus, and it's a different species. It's much bigger also. It's much larger.
Will your rats be working for the police anytime soon?
Well, the group we're working with now is a test group. But maybe their children will, yeah.
Yeah. Aaron, how about the big rats we see on the streets here in New York? And I'm thinking of the four-legged kind. I think we could turn them into honest workers?
It could happen. They are the same species as what we work with in the lab, Rattus norvegicus. And so they really came up to the new world, to the Americas, with the Europeans when they were coming in their ships. So they really are the same strain as what we've been working with in the laboratory.
Let me ask both of you, can you train a rat to take voice commands, to understand like a dog, fetch, sit, roll over, that sort of thing?
To some degree, yes, they can be trained to use vocal cues. So basically they learn a particular signature of something you're saying, like the name that you've given to the rat, and a few other commands. I don't know to the extent of how many of these unique vocal cues rats can learn, but based on my understanding of how they can learn lots of associations between other kind of stimuli, such as odors and even visual cues, I imagine they can learn dozens at least.
Monique, do you have names for your rats?
Yes, they do have names. They're named after people that helped me in the first project, because a few years ago I had another group. They respond to their names. When I call, for example, Ed comes out. Yeah.
Do you get as close personally to your rat as a lovable cat or a dog?
Yeah, well, I must admit I'm a very sentimental detective. So I really love the guys, and I feel attached to them. Mm. They are very, very nice animals, very friendly. They never bite. They never do,
It's so bad things. It's so different than, you know, here living in New York and I'm sure other big cities where we see rats totally in a different light, so to speak, and in reality.
Hear a different context. And they are the wild living rats of the same species. They are difficult. You can't just tame them. My breeder has bred a half wild into our bloodline, and the children were still very fierce and easy at escaping from cages. And the rats I have now, they are like the great-grandchildren of this wild one. Yeah.
I heard one rat expert say that the wild rats, like in New York, are like the wolves are to dogs. You know, they're...
I don't know.
I don't know if it's quite that dramatic a difference, actually, but because the rats haven't gone under the same number of generations of domestication in captivity. But, you know, there's some similarities there,
Do you have pet rats, Aaron?
On and off. Right now I have two pets that are my daughters, Maggie and Helen. And so until my pets go to college, I'm not having any other pets in the house.
Same for you, Monique. Do you have pets?
Right now, I don't, but at the moment that this group will retire, I guess I'll take them home. Yeah.
But they don't live that long, do they, if you get really attached to them?
They live a couple of years.
No, it's like 2-3 years. Yeah, that's the hard thing about training rats and working with them. You have to say goodbye rather fast. Yeah.
Yeah. But you can get sentimental about rats, and I'm sure our listeners will tell us that they have pet rats, because I know a few people who do, and they've been there. They speak so highly of them.
I think they make a much better pet than a hamster, I believe. I think they really form a bond with the human who they live with.
Hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
All right. That's a good note to leave on. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Aaron Blaisdell is a professor of comparative psychology at UCLA. Monique Hammerschlag is an inspector with the Dutch National Police. Monique, good luck with training your rats.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. All right, we're going to take a break, and we want you to keep your cool, because after the break, we're diving into the history of air conditioning. Oh, it's a really interesting history, and where we might be headed next in our quest for cool. If the rest of the world, and we're talking about developing countries, want millions and millions of more air conditioners, how are we going to supply all those people with the electricity and the air conditioners? We'll come up with some alternative ways to stay cool, creative ways. Stay with us. We'll be right back. One of the most difficult things to buy is a mattress, right? Lying on a bed for 4 minutes in a showroom is not very convincing. And you can pay a lot of money for that mattress. Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, has a better idea. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing the savings on to you. That's why Casper offers a 100-day risk-free trial and painless return policy. Their mattresses are obsessively engineered, too. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for just the right sink and just the right bounce. Casper mattresses are made in America and outstandingly priced. $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size. And today, you can save an additional $50. Go to casper.com/scifry and insert the promo code SCIFRY. Casper mattresses for better nights and better mornings. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 2015 is heading to be the hottest year on record, which means not only will you be turning up your air conditioning, but millions of people around the world in developing countries who never had any AC will be seeking to come into the cold. As more of the world gets a taste of air conditioning, as China, India, Brazil want to chill, where is all the electricity going to come from? And is there a more sustainable, non-electric way to keep our cool? Keel Moe is an associate professor of architecture and energy at Harvard in Cambridge. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Moe. Hi there. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Let's talk about air conditioning a little bit. Not a new idea.
No, you know, most of the histories of air conditioning begin with doctors in Florida in the mid-19th century, like John Gorey, who did experiments blowing air over ice. But the history of air, tempering air, is obviously much older than that. So what emerged in the 19th century was the attempt to mechanize air and our interior climates. This was formalized, you know, by the end of the 19th century and early 20th century by individuals like Willis Carrier, who developed the kind of science and engineering behind what we understand to be air conditioning today.
What were some of the early ways they tried out to cool the air?
Well, like I said, the first And the earliest examples, you know, throughout the world often involve ice and controlling airflow over ice. And we would see that, you know, in the archaic world. We'd see that throughout Renaissance villas in Italy. And we certainly saw it in places from, you know, Florida, the southeast, and even into Chicago throughout the 19th century. But we really must understand that much more than just air was conditioned when air conditioning was mechanized and commercialized in this period. Our expectations for comfort, how the building industry was ultimately organized, and patterns in energy consumption and urbanization were all radically skewed when we decided to so enthusiastically engage this air conditioning apparatus.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of what makes you feel better, has always been my experience about air conditioning, is not only is the air cooler, but the air is drier.
Right. Right. And that's the key, you know, dynamic that Willis Carrier resolved was the relationship between temperature and humidity. And he was, you know, he first was introduced to that problem in the context of printing presses in Brooklyn and later in tobacco, you know, cigarette rolling factories in North Carolina. And so he was really looking at factory environments. And I think one of the key points to recognize is that science was never really modified when that air conditioning apparatus moved into buildings and was now dealing with the complexities of human bodies and our physiology.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk now about crunching the numbers on how much energy this addiction to air conditioning costs us, could cost us, how much it's going to cost us when all the people in developing countries decide they want to move up into air-conditioned spaces. And I'm going to do that by bringing on Michael Sivak. He is a research professor at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Tell us about your calculations of how much energy developing countries could potentially use to cool their cities. For example, Mumbai, India.
What I did is to look at the top 50 largest metropolitan areas of the world and also into each individual country, both in terms of how many people there are and also the local temperatures, using an index called cooling degree days. And what I calculated is that Mumbai, for example, has the potential to consume as much energy as a quarter of the United States if they were to adopt the same use of air conditioning as we do.
One city, just Mumbai, would consume as much energy as the whole quarter of the U.S.
Exactly. Now, India, the whole entire country, India, would consume or could potentially consume 14 times as much energy as we do, again, if they were to adopt our frequency of use.
Wow. Akhil, what could we do to cool everybody off without having to draw all that electricity, architecturally speaking?
Well, I think we really need to begin with our bodies, with human physiology and how our bodies actually transfer heat. For instance, we transfer about twice as much heat through radiant transfer as opposed to convective transfer, which is the focus of air conditioning. So already if you begin with thinking about ways of tempering buildings with radiant transfer, you're already two times more efficient in these terms. So there's ways of beginning with the body, its boundary layers, its physiology. And we can come up with much more different ways to think about the relationship between bodies, buildings, and our interior climates. And so some of these ways of approaching the problem of human comfort or cooling, many of them might come from the archaic world. The non-modern world is replete with really cunning ways of removing excess heat, which is what cooling actually is, in the context of buildings and cities. And so a lot of my research involves looking at these completely ingenious systems that can actually be applied throughout the world, not just at the tip of neoliberal capitals, in the way that, you know, sort of new high-tech technologies and smart materials can only be applied. So really, when we start thinking about what we call kind of condescendingly the developing world, I actually think that they have a lot of really interesting answers if we look at it with contemporary eyes and contemporary design.
Well, you have to give me some specifics, for example.
Yeah, so for instance, the Persian, central Persian landscape in like the 1500s was you know, just almost a desert, right? But they had ice, they had sorbet, they had fruit trees growing. And it was, you know, their ability to think in a very, I guess, intuitive ways about the thermodynamics of that region. But they were able to develop all these sophisticated architectures that kept people cool, produced ice in the middle of a desert, et cetera, et cetera.
But you haven't told me how they did that.
Yeah, okay. Well, a lot of it relies upon, let's say, mass. All these were massive buildings, and so they employ radiant transfer. So today, the way that we do some of this is we run cool water through concrete slabs and walls and that sort of thing, what we call thermally active surfaces. And through that mechanism, we can heat and cool building bodies in a very different way that is much more efficacious.
I remember talking with Amory Lovins, who told me that the way he cools his house, and he's a very well-known environmentalist, is that if you dig deep enough under the ground, the temperature is constant all year, and you can heat and cool by sucking, putting heat back into the ground, taking it out.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, we can absolutely couple buildings, these thermally active surface buildings. You know, that water that flows through the building can flow through the ground. It can flow through the air. And so we can either pick up heat or dump heat as necessary. And that place where it's the same temperature all year is not that far down. So it's quite easy to connect and couple a building that way. Yes.
Michael, are we being overly alarmist about talking about the potential demand in Europe and India and China?
I don't think so. When you look at all countries of the world in terms of their population and their temperature, the fact is that most of the developing countries are in a hot climate. So as soon as they are able to afford it, they will get air conditioning. They will get the luxury that we have used for the last 100 years or so. My calculations show that the future demand in all countries of the world has the potential to exceed the current demand in the U.S. by a factor of 50.
50,
which is a huge multiplier.
And how soon would that be?
Well, the income in, quote, developing countries is rising rapidly. So, for example, in India, in 2007, only about 2% of households had air conditioning. That percentage is growing by 20% every year. So they're probably close to 10% by now. The 2% is from 2007. Mm-hmm. So the global energy demand for air conditioning will grow substantially as nations become more affluent.
Are they going to say the same thing to us if we say, you know, you should try something differently? Are they going to say, well, you have it, why shouldn't we have it?
I think they will tell us the latter, and I think appropriately so. I think there are at least two things that we can do to show how to do things better. First of all, we need to develop more efficient air conditioners. There's some research ongoing in the U.S. National Renewable Energy Lab suggesting that efficiency improvements of 20 to 70% are possible. Now, the second and maybe even more important point is that we need to change our usual pattern of thermostat setting. Americans tend to keep their thermostat at about the same temperature all year round. In contrast, Europeans tend to set their thermostats higher in summer and lower in winter. Therefore, while indoors, Europeans wear sweaters in winter to keep warm, while Americans wear sweaters in summer to keep warm, which is very ironic.
Turning
the thermostat down by 1% saves about 2% of the energy used.
Now, we just saw that story last week about women are much colder in the workplace because the old standards were based on men calculating men's energy and not women and wearing sweaters in the offices, like you say. Kiel, are there historical precedents that suggest keeping cool transcends cultural borders? I mean...
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly, as Mike mentioned, the expectations for comfort vary widely throughout the world and throughout history, and certainly Americans have you know designed their way into a very narrow range of what they consider to be comfortable. But electricity consumption and comfort, these are one things. We also recently, just in the New York Times yesterday, there was a whole new set of reports on Legionnaire disease and different parts of Manhattan, and all of the large buildings are going to have to be checked for this. So there's other sort of public health issues beyond electricity consumption and the climate change implications of that as well that we would have to consider, you know, because when we develop a technology like air conditioning, you know, as others have said, to develop the ship is to develop the shipwreck, right? And so we never really imagine the ways in which these kinds of technologies deprive us, right? So there are many other ways to think about how to cool a body that I think are more ecologically sane, that are more architecturally powerful and experientially more delightful. And I think that we have to think beyond just energy efficiency, which has a whole set of scientific problems associated with it, even though it's the dominant means of talking about energy.
One of those materials you talk about is just plain wood. Learn how to use wood better.
Yeah, I mean, architects and engineers really have no idea what a piece of wood can do or what a piece of concrete can do. So I think thinking about these so-called dumb materials like wood and concrete in really smart and intelligent ways, understanding more about their properties and their capacities and potential geometries is a really powerful way that to be thinking about tempering interior climates throughout the world, not just in, again, in neoliberal world capitals.
I very much agree with Kiel that we need to improve housing design and urban planning. Unfortunately, those kind of changes require more time and resources. You can't turn over housing stock in the world very quickly. So we need to work on both fronts, you know, the housing design as well as the energy efficiency, which could be done much more rapidly and in some sense cheaply.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Michael Savak and Akhil Mo. So what I hear you saying, Michael, is that's a great long-term solution, but it's not going to help us out in the next decade, two decades, whatever.
That is correct. I don't want to minimize the importance of housing design because it's very important, but it takes a long time to turn over the current stock.
Mm-hmm. But this is something that people discuss among architects and city planners, the need to do this. Michael, Kiel?
Absolutely. No, it's a central concern in schools of architecture and design and urbanism today, for sure. And yes, I mean, energy efficiency can be important. But it's also, I mean, to some degree, it's doing less bad, right? I think if we can work with these so-called developing countries about their rapidly developing housing stock and building stock, we can have a huge impact. You know, some of my colleagues are doing that in Medellin, Colombia right now. It's quite staggering to see how interested these municipalities and regions are in some of these alternatives. They know what's coming.
Yeah.
Well,
what about systems that would transfer energy directly from the body instead of trying to cool the whole room, just cool the body itself? I would imagine where you have military forces all over hot climates, the Army or the military must be very interested in this kind of thing.
Absolutely. They've been looking at these kinds of, you know, immediate body scale technologies for a long time. One example is a MEMS device, basically a kind of heat transfer plate that you place near the back of the neck. It's a lot like putting an ice cube on the back of your neck. You can actually, you know, through the glands associated with that area, you know, quite rapidly cool a body, but also make your body, you know, kind of trick it into thinking it's much cooler. There's some danger in that you can actually overheat a body without it really registering that. But yeah, there are definitely body scale ways of thinking about this problem. And that's the scale at which we should be thinking about it. We should be thinking about the scale of cooling at the scale that we want it, which is at the body, not the scale of the whole building or whole cities, which is what we have now.
Let me see if go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Kiel that this is a very important area. I want to just add that in addition to changing the housing stock and improving the energy efficiency, we need to work on cultural norms and have impact very quickly on what we find acceptable in terms of temperature.
That means learn how to turn the thermostat up a little higher?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, because we've always said that the lowest hanging fruit is energy efficiency and insulation and things like that.
And I mean, there is a general saying that high-end shops and stores tend to keep their temperature much lower in summer than stores that are not perceived as prestigious. In some sense, a low temperature is a sign of something expensive, something desirable, and I think we need to work on this to change that attitude.
And I think that goes back to the days when we were kids, when the movie theater said, come on in, it's cool inside,
yes.
Right?
Exactly.
Before we all had air conditioning around. Gentlemen, thank you both for taking time to talk with us today. Akhil Moe, Associate Professor of Architecture and Energy at Harvard and Cambridge. Michael Savak is a Research Professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Have a good weekend to both of you.
Many thanks.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about babies laughing, babies having a good time, babies understanding complex jokes. Not just coochie-coochie-coo. We'll talk about it. We'll show you after we get back after the break. Hey, podcast listeners. When I was told that we had a new podcast advertiser, Harry's.com, I said, great. I already know those folks because I use their razor and blades. No need to talk me into it. And you know what I like about Harry's? It's that there's a bunch of entrepreneurs dedicated to making shaving a better experience through great design, meticulous craftsmanship, terrific value, and highly personal and dedicated customer service. Makes sense we'd get together, doesn't it? Harry's uses high-quality German-made blades and razors that virtually eliminate razor burn and nicks. And they cost half the price of other razors. And they deliver them right to your door. Harry's literally takes the pain out of shaving. And because you are a Sci-Fi podcast listener, you're going to get a special discount. A Harry's starter set that includes a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and three razor blades for just $15. And if you order now at Harry's.com, they're going to give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code FRIDAY with your first purchase. It's an amazing shave without the hassle from Harry's.com, and you can't beat it. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Ah, yes, the sound of a baby laughing. As a parent, you know, there's probably nothing you wouldn't do to get your kid to laugh, right? And I bet your first joke your kid really got a kick out of was, peekaboo, I see you. Remember that one? Peekaboo seems to be one of the first jokes kids learn. But as it turns out, as babies age, they can understand more complex jokes. And these jokes and games like playing pretend appear to be beneficial to their psychological development. Dr. Elena Hoiku wrote a study in the journal Cognitive Science on this topic. She's a lecturer at Developmental Psychology, University of Sheffield in England. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hoiku.
Hi, how are you?
You're going to also help us analyze some stories of joking and playing pretend from parents on Science Friday's own staff. But I want to talk to you about this. In your study, parents pretended a rubber chicken was a hat.
Well, not exactly. So we're actually looking at whether parents would distinguish joking and pretending for their kids. So what we're really looking at is, would they give different cues if they were joking or pretending? So a typical joke might be putting something like a rubber chicken on your head. Pretending for, you know, toddlers, these kids were between 16 and 24 months, might be drinking out of an empty cup, or it might be pretending maybe a block is a hat, something not nondescript. And so what we wanted to see was, do they just think these two concepts are the same, or joking and pretending just the same thing, or do they give different cues? And what we found is that parents treated joking and pretending really differently. When they were pretending, they're kind of really endorsing what they were doing. They're repeating the actions. They were saying, like, this is how you put on a hat, even if it wasn't a hat. But if they were joking around, they would, you know, really explain to their kids that this wasn't for real. So they would repeat the actions less often. They'd say things like, that's not how you, you know, put on a hat. That's not really a hat. And kids were picking up on this. So kids were less likely to do the actions when the parents were joking versus pretending. And they were more likely to say things like no or don't when they were joking. And it seems that parents, the thing about pretending is it's technically wrong. You know, if I put anything on my head as a hat that's not a hat, that's kind of weird. When you take a kid out of that context, if I'm doing that at the shop, you know, putting a shoe on my head, people are going to think that's really strange. But when you're doing it with kids, what you're setting up is this situation where on the surface it's wrong, but in your imagination, it's actually totally right and it's totally normal. And parents are really pushing that, let's learn from this. This is totally normal. But when you're joking, that's not the point. You're trying out different things, but you don't want to take it seriously.
Fascinating. Yeah. The kids can tell the difference. Our video producer at Science Friday, Luke Raskin, used to do the hat joke with his son when he was 16 months old or so. But then his son put a new spin on the joke.
Yeah.
That joke morphed into let's put a hat on the cat, but it wasn't just like let's take a ball cap and put it on the cat. Let's take, you know, like a blanket and put it on the cat and call it a hat, which is a double joke. Very clever of him. And he thought that was very funny. The cat did not appreciate it.
Did Luke's son understand that he was telling a joke?
I think what's really interesting about this example is that he's not just copying it, but he's making a new joke of it, which suggests to me he probably does. And in a past study we ran, we had kids first copy jokes that we did, similar. It was kind of like giving wrong objects. And then we saw if they could make up their own following the same lines. And it sounds like this is exactly what this boy's done. So I would think that there's a good chance he knew what was going on. And he was coming up with his own jokes, which is really clever, especially at that really young age. Yeah.
Yeah. How do the babies figure out if the parent is joking? I mean, what's going on there?
I mean, the parents are basically telling them. So what we did these kind of, it's called time lag sequential analysis. I won't get into the details, but basically we looked at the kids' behaviors in relation to the parents' behaviors. And what we found is that kids were following up on what the parents were doing, and that's what was helping them figure it out. So if a parent says, that's not really a hat, and the kids say no, or, you know, they stop putting it on their head or things like that. If the parents say, yeah, that, you know, goes on my head, then the kids might put the hat on their head, or not the hat, you know, whatever the object is, on their head. So they are distinguishing these contexts, but their parents are helping them tremendously, even though I doubt the parents even really realize exactly what they're doing. Whether they could do this on their own at this age, I'm not totally sure yet. It seems like the parents are really helping them.
I want to bring another example in, as Annie Nero on our staff plays pretend with her daughter here. And let's hear how her daughter responded.
So my daughter was wearing a dress that had strawberries on it. So my husband and I started picking the strawberries off and pretending to eat them. And she was looking at us very inquisitively for a few seconds, trying to figure out what we were doing. And suddenly I saw it click, and it was almost like she was like, oh, you guys are pretending. Okay, I get it. And so she started taking the strawberries off of the dress and feeding them to us, and then began taking them and fake feeding them to herself, basically. So it was really neat to see that.
Well, take us through what happened there to her daughter from a psychological perspective during this bit of play pretend.
Yeah, so again, it looks like, you know, initially looks like, well, first, she maybe wasn't quite getting it. And what the parents may have been doing, like the parents in our study, is they may have been giving clues without realizing it. So they may have said, we're eating strawberries, or they may have made sound effects or something like that to help her figure it out. And then she may have realized it. And again, in this example, she's not only copying it, but again, she's making it her own, because she's both feeding her parents and herself. So she seems to be extending the situation as well.
Is there a cue between parent and child that leads to going peekaboo ICU so early is like the first thing that they do? Is there something hardwired that makes us all want to do that?
So that's an interesting question. So I did another study in the past where we found that before the first year, most babies will do their own version of peekaboo. And there's been research by other people like Casper Adaman and Gina Miro, which has found that, peekaboo is pretty popular. But also, even then, parents are really helping babies, even at that young age, understand what's going on. So in the study by Gina Miro, they looked at babies from 3 to 6 months, had parents joke around with them. And at 3 months, babies just laughed randomly. But by 6 months, they seemed to be laughing when parents did silly things like blowing raspberries or making horse sounds or things like that. But it might be because parents were always pairing up their silly actions with laughter, and babies kind of started to figure out, okay, we laugh when people do weird stuff. So in the one sense, they have to realize something weird or exciting, I think, in the case of peekaboo is happening. But again, parents are really helping them. And even in the 70s, they did peekaboo with like robots and strangers, and babies won't laugh then. They need this kind of safe environment. They need their parents.
Oh, no kidding.
If it's like a stranger, they kind of freak out a little bit. Not all strangers. You might do it on a bus. You might be okay. But it's much more effective with someone they know. Yeah. So there's there's a very big social element, as well as them having to realize there's something kind of different, strange going on
When you make funny faces at babies, sometimes they react. Do they know about that also without having to say anything, just the weird face?
Yeah, so that's also something that they enjoy in the first year, and they start producing themselves certainly in the second year. I think they really enjoy that. There's something, I guess, the thing with peekaboo and funny faces is it's in the face. They like to look at faces anyway. And there's something strange they can see about it, but it's also probably the case that parents have done it in the past. They've laughed about it afterwards, and that helps them figure it out.
How does all this playing and pretend and all of this contribute to a toddler's development?
So I think the really interesting thing about pretending and joking is that they seem on the surface to be really similar, but I think they have really different purposes. And pretending offers you a situation where you're doing something non-literal, it's not real, but you can practice something real. And recent research has shown that kids are really good at learning in pretend contexts. So you can imagine if you want to teach kids about giraffes or lemurs and you don't have any at hand, you could be like, oh, we're pretending we're giraffes, we're eating leaves, we've got long necks. And they can learn a lot of information in that serious way without having to have everything right in front of them. Joking, on the other hand, I think can be really useful for kids to try to think outside the box. So it's a situation where you're allowed to do weird things. You're happy about it. It's social. If we didn't do that, we couldn't come up with new ideas. We couldn't come up with new inventions. So I think joking might help kids practice coming up with new types of culture, and pretending might help them learn about culture.
For all the new parents and grandparents out there, can you give us a certain joke that's really good, that works well with their little babies?
With babies. So I would say with like under the first, and in the first year, kind of 6 to 12 months, peekaboo. It's always a winner. if you know the kid, don't do it with a robot. And I think when they're a bit older, when they start to know how objects work, so kind of one-year-olds, put anything on your head that doesn't go on your head. It's just always funny. You can put a sock, a shoe, a cup. It all works really well.
So audiences start real young. Dr. Hoike, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Elaine Hoike is a lecturer of developmental psychology at the University of Sheffield in England. Next up, video producer Luke Raskin is here to talk about, not about his baby this time, but the latest video in our Macroscope series, which you can see right now up on sciencefriday.com. It's sort of a creature feature, Luke, right? What's under the macroscope this week?
Well, this week we have a story of rebirth in a river, of a life of a river teeming with life. So, Ira, I'm going to ask you, when you think of a river that's just filled with life, with biodiversity, what do you think of?
A river filled with life?
Yeah.
The Amazon, something like that.
That's a good one. How about the Cahaba?
You ever heard of that? The Cahaba.
I thought it's a cup of coffee.
How about the Coosa? The Coosa River.
That's even worse. I don't know where that is.
Well, both of these rivers are part of the a whole network of rivers inside Alabama. There are 10 individual river basins inside Alabama, and combined with their own little set of species in each, and altogether, they're one of the most biodiverse areas in the entire world.
Well, because I always knew that Alabama was good for fishing, but I didn't realize why they have all this biodiversity.
They have all of these invertebrates. They're mussels, snails, and crayfish, and they have more of those than any place else in the world. The more biodiverse. So in any given section of any given river, you're going to find unique creatures that are not going to be found anywhere else in the world. So our video, which is up on sciencefriday.com, called The Unlikely Tale of a Tenacious Snail, follows the story of one such species, the oblong rock snail. And it lives only in one little section of the Cahaba River. I should say that it only lived. So it disappeared, actually, in 1933. People didn't know where it went. And it hadn't been seen for over 80 years. And in 2000, they thought it was extinct. They actually declared it extinct. Until in 2011, they actually found it again.
By accident? Or were they looking for it?
Well, they were doing a survey. This is a biologist by the name of Nathan Whalen. And he went out there with his buddies. And he's got a trained eye, so he studies invertebrates. He's out kayaking, and he hops out of his kayak, and he picks up a rock, and he starts looking around at it. Oh, there's something interesting there.
Well, I picked up the first one, and I took a look at it, and I was looking at my hand, and I was like, well, that looks pretty suspicious. I might want to hold on to this one for a second, and started picking up a couple other snails, and once I had two or three that looked like what I was looking for, I started screaming, "Hey guys, you got to come down here and take a look at this!" And I'm pretty sure they thought I was crazy.
And they verified that.
Yes, they did.
Took it back?
They collected 30, and they brought them back to this place called the Alabama Aquatic Biodiversity Center, where they could kind of breed it, and they could look at it and dissect one or two of them and see and to verify if it's actually the species.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with our video producer, Luke Raskin, about the unlikely tale of a tenacious snail.
Indeed.
Continue, please.
So how do you actually find out if this animal is the animal from way back when? How do you do that? You have to compare it to museum specimens, and one of the ways they can do that is by looking at the teeth of the snail.
Wait. I'm sorry. Snail have teeth.
Thousands of them.
Like a shark? I mean, it's like, yeah,
well,
wow.
Well, not exactly like a shark. They have this thing called a radula, and inside their mouths is like this strip of teeth which they use to scrape the surfaces for algae or whatever they're going to eat, vegetation. And so each of these species, or a lot of these species, have unique radula, have a unique structure to their teeth. It's kind of like a fingerprint, a little bit like a fingerprint.
It's like forensics. You look at the teeth. They compared the teeth.
They compared the 1881 teeth to the 2011 teeth, and they had a match. The oblong rock snail was back.
Wow. So have they gone looking for more of them?
Well, they haven't found them in any place else, and that's a good point. What they want to do is, and what they are doing, is they collected a whole bunch of them. They're breeding them at the Alabama Aquatic Biodiversity Center, along with a whole bunch of other invertebrates, a lot of mussels, with some crazy names like the orange knicker mucket, or the Coosa moccasin shell, or the pale lilliput. There's so many fascinating names and fascinating species.
And they're unique to Alabama.
They're unique to Alabama, and they're unique to specific tributaries and rivers in Alabama. So you're not going to find, the orange knicker mucket in every single river. You're only going to find it in a specific section of a specific river. And they're breeding them, and then they go out and they put them in a place where they didn't find them originally. They also tag them, which I found kind of crazy. They tag snails and
it's a tiny tag.
It's a really, really tiny tag. They tag them when they're pretty young. That way they can go back to the site 10 years later and they can track their progress to see are they still there. And they're pretty long-lived creatures.
So you think they can find maybe more? Maybe there are other extinct species or mussels.
Well, this isn't the first one. This is one of seven Lazarus species.
Oh, is that right?
Species that have come back from the dead that they thought had gone extinct. Dr. Paul Johnson, the facility director, he's gone through seven, and that's a pretty big achievement to go through seven different species back from the brink from extinction.
The video or pick of the week, our video is The Unlikely Tale of a Tenacious Snail. Indeed. How hard was it to shoot this video.
Well, there's a lot of, of time standing in a river or with a GoPro, it's actually really gorgeous down there. I recommend that if anybody is down in Birmingham or going down to Alabama, you make it out to the Cahaba River. It's really gorgeous. It's made a really big comeback from the 1990s because of the Clean Water Act and some sewage wastewater treatment upgrades that went on in Birmingham. Wow. And now all the species are coming back. It's just great. A gorgeous river.
That's great. There's the summer vacation, last-minute summer vacation, going out to Alabama, and the river is down there. All right, Luke, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Luke Raskin, Science Friday's video producer. You can check out our macroscope video. It's the unlikely tale of a tenacious snail at sciencefriday.com. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And, oh, by the way, it's Happy International Beer Day. You heard me right. Did you know your favorite brew is an example of some frothy physics? And you can grab a cold one and hit the sciencefriday.com/beerfoam to learn more about the physics of beer. And while you're there, you can leave us some email or go to our website, sciencefriday.com, and join our mailing list. Also, if you like us on Facebook. And we tweet all week at SciFi.